And that's true. But we don't need the pollution that comes with them, and they can do better. The question is, will they? And in Texas, they won't do it because the legislature and regulatory agencies simply won't push for it. Or as Eric said earlier, they won't change the laws to keep pace with technology and the changing times. Once again, Motiva is the largest refinery in the country. And pretty soon, my old refinery in Beaumont, 15 miles to the north of us, will be the second largest. So now you have two major polluters that are going to be right here in a very small area in Southeast Texas. Something has to be done. This is not right. This is not good for the people that live here. It's not good for the planet. And it's not good for any of you, whether or not you live by the Gulf of Mexico or any large body of water, because all water is interconnected. This pollution is serious, and something must be done to address it. And I once again commend all of you for your work in bringing attention to this. Let's continue the fight. Let's clean up our waterways so that they can be safe, swimmable, and we can eat from them and we can enjoy them. That's the way it was meant to be. Let's take the measures to make that happen and be that way once again. Thank you.
Thank you. That was John Beard, Executive Director of the Port Arthur Community Action Network. And now from Houston, we have Kristen Schlemmer, Legal Director of the Bayou City Waterkeepers. Go ahead, Kristen.
Hi, I'm Kristen Schlemmer, the Legal Director and Waterkeeper for Bayou City Waterkeeper, which is a water justice nonprofit based in Houston, Texas, down the coast from Port Arthur, where Mr. Beard is. We work across the greater Houston region. So 7 of the 10 worst polluters for total dissolved solids dumped into waterways in 2021, according to this report, were in Texas. I'm going to talk about 2 of the worst, both of which are located in the greater Houston region, and what this means for the people and ecosystems who live here. The worst polluter for total dissolved solids, according to the report, is the ExxonMobil Baytown refinery. The report shows that ExxonMobil released into the Houston Ship Channel almost 127 million pounds of chlorides, sulfites, and other dissolved solids, all of which can be harmful to aquatic life. This in itself is astounding, 127 million pounds. And it becomes even more so when you consider what it means to be the worst. When you think about who and what this 127 million pounds of pollution affects, Baytown, where the refinery is located, isn't an industrial zone, but a small city east of Houston where 80,000 people live, work, go to school, and are forced to do all of this alongside this pollution day in and day out. This pollution goes into the Houston Ship Channel, which is a body of water connecting this pollution to other people and ecosystems. On one side, the Ship Channel flows in and out of Buffalo Bayou, a long and popular body of water which cuts through 53 miles of Houston, winding through downtown Houston and past neighborhoods, including my own. Houstonians view Buffalo Bayou as one of the jewels of our city, and walkers, bikers, kayakers fill the area mornings, evenings, and weekends. When we've had disastrous flooding, like in Hurricane Harvey, the water in this bayou and everything in it escapes the bayou's banks and covers the entire surrounding park and sometimes enters people's homes. Thanks to polluters like those described in this report, people don't have to just worry about flooding, but the toxic chemicals it might bring to them. On the other side of the Ship Channel is Galveston Bay, which connects to a string of bays and flows into the Gulf of Mexico. Millions of people rely on Galveston for sustenance through both commercial and recreational fishing. Insufficiently checked water pollution can make this food unhealthy to consume. So 127 million isn't just a very big number. With this broader context, I hope you see that this very large number is connected to very large stakes for both human and environmental health in our region. The other location I'd like to highlight from the report is the Phillips 66 Sweeney Refinery south of Houston, which exceeded its permitted pollution limits 44 times from 2019 to 2021. And for those violations, it was penalized just $30,000, according to EPA records. So 42 of the refinery's 44 violations were for unpermitted cyanide pollution in the Brazos River, which is upstream from a string of popular public beaches that are filled with people nearly every weekend, as well as a national wildlife refuge. Again, 44 violations, 42 of which are for cyanide, present really high stakes for the environment and people, and $30,000 doesn't even begin to offset this. That's not even a tap on the wrist for a company like Phillips 66. In closing, when Houston pops up in the news, it's often because of disasters like Hurricane Harvey. This report shows that many people in the Houston region and all along the Texas coast are being forced to live with another kind of disaster that is invisible to us every day. EIP's report backs up what we all know with real data. For far too long, Houston and the Gulf as a whole have been treated like a sacrifice zone, with the greatest burdens falling on low-income Black and Brown communities, including those living along the Houston Ship Channel. This isn't new, but this report gives us one clear way to make a difference with really compelling data. The EPA is in the position to take action now. EPA can update long outdated rules to account for the realities of the 21st century and act to hold polluters accountable to these rules through consistent enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Kristen Schlemmer, the legal director of Bayou City River Waterkeepers in Houston. Now from San Francisco, we have Sejal Choksi Chu, executive director of the San Francisco Baykeepers. Go ahead, Sejal.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sejal Choksi Chu, the executive director of San Francisco Baykeeper. Our mission is to defend the Bay from the biggest polluters and hold government agencies accountable. And the Bay Area has a long history of hosting 5 active oil refineries. And that means Baykeeper has been fighting refinery pollution for more than 30 years. One of our first legal actions in the early 90s was to hold ExxonMobil accountable for selenium pollution in San Francisco Bay. And that battle against selenium pollution for the refineries is still ongoing, as I'm about to get to in a minute. In the early 2000s, we also compelled local agencies to investigate Bay Area refineries for the mercury pollution they contributed to the Bay. That win was undermined when the refinery's own internal analysis somehow found that the high levels of mercury in their crude inputs miraculously disappear during the refining process. And then the agency asked no further questions. Since 2007, we've helped draft and pass over 14 state laws dealing with oil spills, and most recently, a law to make it harder for refineries to ship heavy crude oils on the Bay. Along with our community partners, we've stopped 3 refinery expansion proposals in Pittsburgh, Benicia, and Rodeo over the last 10 years. And we've caught refineries polluting red-handed. We recently captured drone footage of Valero dumping petroleum coke, which is a dirty refinery byproduct, into the Bay and nearby neighborhoods in Benicia. We're currently in court making the company clean up its polluting operations. In another recent story from 2021, a caller to our pollution hotline reported seeing oil in the water near the Chevron refinery in Richmond. We activated our field team, and Baykeeper's investigator was the first responder to arrive on the scene. He put our drone in the air and saw that the oil sheen had already spread to public beaches, sensitive eelgrass beds, and a known herring spawning site. Surprisingly, Chevron's response crew was nowhere to be found. It turned out that they had no automatic leak detection system. This multi-billion dollar company found out about their own oil spill because a local resident saw the oil in the water and pointed it out to a Chevron employee who happened to be standing outside. The pipe had no auto shutoff valve and spilled about 800 gallons of oil into the Bay before the company stopped the leak. Despite the local outcry and a special city council inquiry, Chevron was allowed to conduct its own internal investigation. It took the company 8 months to submit what's supposed to be a 30-day incident report. That's a common refinery tactic, to slow everything down and delay until the public loses interest or becomes distracted. The explanation for the leak ended up being corrosion in the pipe. Since corrosion can be identified in advance and repaired long before leaks occur, this was basically a maintenance failure. That pipe had been inspected in the past year, but apparently it was not checked for corrosion. The state recently issued Chevron a penalty amounting to $70,000 for the incident. That means they paid less than $90 per gallon for the oil they spilled. And as Kristen said, that's not even a slap on the wrist. I actually say it's a fist bump between the agencies and the Chevron execs. And that seems to be the norm between California agencies and our local refineries. Even though California has a reputation of being an environmentally friendly place, our agencies have the backs of refineries. And we see this favoring playing out in their regulations too. San Francisco Bay is officially recognized as impaired by selenium pollution. And a 2016 cleanup plan known as a TMDL under the Clean Water Act was supposed to mandate reductions in selenium discharges around the bay through Clean Water Act permits. However, the local selenium standard adopted in the TMDL and then implemented into permits was improperly based on fish muscle tissue studies rather than fish organ tissue. And so EPA set the permit discharge levels too high, and coincidentally, those levels were above what the refineries were already discharging. The single largest known selenium polluter in the Bay is the PBF Martinez Refining Company. Their discharge permit under the Clean Water Act was up for renewal this past fall. So Baykeeper submitted into the record new scientific studies from 2020 on the Sacramento split tail. This is a fish that's found nowhere else in the world except for the San Francisco Bay Delta. The studies showed that these fish are experiencing severe deformities directly due to high levels of refinery selenium discharges. These studies were based on organ tissue findings for selenium, and this is a toxic pollutant that bioaccumulates up the food chain. The split tail, are part of a local subsistence fishing industry that supports many families around the Delta, meaning people eat the fish and are exposed to the selenium too. The local agency ignored all of the evidence and adopted the new permit, stating that EPA was in the process of revising the selenium standards for the Bay. And until then, the agency was going to stick with the outdated standards. But EPA has been in the process of creating those standards for years, and they have no timeline for finalizing them. This new permit allows the Martinez refinery to continue discharging selenium at the same rate it has done since the early 2000s, despite known harm to fish and potential danger to people who depend on fish from the Bay. EPA and local agencies' refusal to regulate selenium and other refinery pollutions is a total disgrace. It's offensive to the people who live and depend on a healthy San Francisco Bay. And it certainly doesn't meet the government's obligations to protect us all from toxic industry pollution. We appreciate this EIP report exposing the problems of refinery regulation and the opportunity to share how Baykeeper will continue pushing the agencies to hold refineries accountable. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Sejal Choksi-Chu, Executive Director of San Francisco Baykeeper. And now from Chicago, our closer, Mitch McNeil, Chair of the Surfrider Foundation Chicago Chapter. Go ahead, Mitch.
Okay, I am Mitch McNeil, Chair of Surfrider Chicago Chapter, and I am also a member of the surfing community here. So I'm kind of wearing two hats on this story. It's probably good to familiarize ourselves with the geography. If you look at a map of Lake Michigan, it's kind of long and oval, and we call the south end because it sits right down there on the south, and it catches the big waves that come down during a north wind. That's a over 300 mile fetch, which means length of water, so it has a long runway to build up into surfable waves. So with its industrial backdrop there, you may wonder why surfers are in this dirty water, but it all has to do with the size of the waves. And so back to the south end, it's dominated by the state of Indiana. Indiana has a 60-mile stake in the shoreline there. Of those 60 miles, 45 are privately owned. By that, I mean facilities like BP and U.S. Steel. So it is heavily industrial. and fenced off and mysterious and spooky. They not only put stuff in the water, they put stuff in the air and the soil. And the communities that surround these facilities are low income, Black and brown, underserved. So it's a kind of a familiar scenario. It's not picturesque, but we surfers love it because the waves are big and it gives us something to do year round. But the trade-off is we're surfing in dirty water, and I don't need to list all the stuff that they put in the water. It's all in the report. Famously, they U.S. Steel dumped hexavalent chromium in a massive amount about 6 years ago, and Surfrider Foundation, along with City of Chicago, took them to court. So U.S. Steel, just another player there, along with BP and a few others. Unlike the others that are speaking today, I'm a little different because I'm talking about water that's fresh water, and it's drinking water for tens of millions of people in the Great Lakes. And Lake Michigan, when you combine it with Lake Huron, is considered a closed system in that the water that's in there has nowhere to go. And that also includes the pollutants and plastic trash that we put in the lake in just astonishing numbers. So that creates a system that is kind of alarming to all of us, because these facilities depend on dispersal. They see how many quintillion gallons of water there is, and they say, well, whatever we put in there is going to disperse, but it's not a foolproof method. As a surfer, along with my surfing brothers and sisters, we have all been chastened by the quality of the water, and have developed physical problems like skin rashes and eye irritation, things with the urinary tract, really horrible stuff from the water. So it's not ideal, but it's our place to surf, because there's not too many other places. So I know personally of surfers who have stopped surfing in the South End because of the quality of the water. And that's a decision everyone has to make on their own. But we're constantly asked, why would you surf in that water? And our comeback to that is, well, we surf in it, but you drink it, so you should be as concerned as we are about it. As a group, we're calling a foul on the whole system. We just simply want the authorities to enforce rules that are already on the book, and we want the refineries to walk a straight line. It's time for us all to stand together to protect our lake and our own personal health and the health of the surrounding communities. So that's my story. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Mitch. Really appreciate it. Now we're going to open up to questions from reporters. If you have a question, raise your hand or put a note in the chat, and I will call on you. And also remember to unmute yourself before you ask your question. I see two hands up. Let's see, who do we have? Let's see here. Looks like Blanca Begert. And Blanca, which publication are you from?
Hi, I'm Blanca, and I'm a reporting fellow with Grist. Thank you so much for this and for the great work, and appreciate all the people who spoke. I guess I have a question, and I'm sorry if this is like, I don't want to ask something that's too outside the scope of the report, but we've been reading a lot about like the EPA's issues with staffing and missing all these deadlines to regulate like lots of different things. And I just was hoping that someone could maybe speak a little bit to like why the EPA has not updated and is not doing this, like from all your perspectives.
Well, Eric Schaefer used to work at EPA for many years, the former director of enforcement at EPA. Eric, what are your thoughts?
So it's a great question, and it's one we struggle with. The agency's definitely lost staff, and that needs to be addressed. We've, you know, pushed Congress to do that. We've seen some glimmerings of hope in the appropriations bill for this year, where the agency's resources for enforcement were increased significantly for the first time in more than a decade. Senator Durbin was part of that. I just have to give him credit. He's got very determined staff who are really pushing on this. So there's a little bit of hope on the horizon, but it's a problem that has to be tackled. I think what EPA did maybe 20 years ago, and this might have been partly for political reasons, but also maybe well meant, is they decided instead of looking at the technology-based standards, we're going to shift our focus and see if we can improve the water quality standards, which the Clean Water